to the Indonesian government and army. But on May the 18th, 1958, an incident takes place which reveals the reality behind this secret. One of the rebels' bombing aircraft is hit and falls. The pilot is found alive by the Indonesian army. Alan Pope, the pilot of the aircraft, is American. This news shocks everyone. What is on the mind of everyone is why America should be involved in overthrowing Indonesia's first government after its independence. Especially since Indonesia's government was in good terms with America.
Bandung is an attractive place high up in the hills of Western Java. It's here that the Afro-Asian Conference is being held, and worldwide attention is drawn to the scene of this unique meeting.
Most countries attending the Afro-Asian Conference were fledgling states who had just gained their independence. The aim of the conference was to establish economic and cultural ties between Asia and Africa. It was in this conference that the initial idea of the non-aligned movement came about, and it was established a few years later in the former Yugoslavia in 1961. The conference was in fact a message to the East and West blocs. The members of the conference suggested a world movement whose members could envision their future without the interference of Moscow or Washington. Only a few days after the Afro-Asian Conference, the White House ordered the CIA to be ready. This order was revealed 40 years after it was issued, and it was to punish Sukarno, or better yet, to overthrow him. In 1927, Ahmet Sukarno, with his like-minded friends, established a pro-independence party, the Indonesian National Party, PNI, of which Sukarno was elected the first leader. After the end of World War II, the Dutch, with the help of the British, tried in vain to return to their centuries-old colony, but they were met with the defiance of the Indonesian people. In the end, the Dutch were forced to accept the independence of Indonesia.
In the Royal Palace at Amsterdam, the transfer of sovereignty creating a new independent republic, the United States of Indonesia, has been completed. Queen Juliana, attended by her ministers and in the presence of members of the States General, was the first to put her signature to the document. Mr. Mohammed Hatta, the Indonesian Prime Minister, signed the act of transfer and the statute of the Netherlands-Indonesian Union.
A CIA operative in Indonesia informed his bosses that Sukarno insists on the involvement of the Indonesian Communist Party in the governance of the country. Sukarno's justification for this was that 6 million people voted for the party in the July 1957 elections, and the party held the third place of power in the country. Everything was ready for the communist phobia project to start. On the 30th of November the same year, a grenade was thrown at Sukarno in front of a school. He escaped the assassination attempt unharmed, but 10 people were killed and 48 children were injured. The CIA blamed the communists for the assassination, but later it was discovered that the assassination had no connections with the Communist Party. Al Ulmer, chief of the Far East Division of the CIA's Directorate of Plans, believed that the rebels in Sumatra must be armed and organized so that they could take control in the capital city and put an end to the communists' gain of power. According to CIA documents, on the 25th of September, President Eisenhower ordered Alan Dulles to carry out a coup in Indonesia. It only took 3 months to plan the operation in detail. A huge operation room was created in the southeast of Asia, and all top CIA figures were present there. They contacted some of the rebel leaders in Sumatra who called themselves Permesta. On the 21st of February, the Indonesian Navy destroyed the rebels' radio stations in the heartland of Sumatra and seized their positions in the shoreline. The bombing started on the 19th of April, 1958. One of the CIA pilots that took part in this mission was Alan Lawrence Pope. He carried out his first mission in Indonesia on the 27th of April. In the next 3 weeks, he and his compatriots bombarded military and civilian targets in villages and ports across Indonesia. The U.S. Embassy's report on the bombings confirms that hundreds of civilians were killed in the attacks. In the final days of April, Sukarno's forces managed to completely defeat the Sumatra rebels, and in the midst of the conflict, five CIA officers who were in Sumatra fled to the jungles. In the early hours of Sunday, 18th of May, Alan Pope was carrying out a covert bombing mission in Indonesia. While flying over the Ambon Island sky, he sank an Indonesian Navy ship, bombed a marketplace, and destroyed a church. At this point, the B-26 Invader Pope was piloting was shot by anti-aircraft artillery, and the aircraft caught fire at 6,000 feet. Pope had his identification documents, his mission reports, and Clark Air Base pilot card in his pocket. These documents identified him as an American pilot. Pope jumped out of his aircraft with a parachute and was caught by Indonesian government forces. In the afternoon of the same day, a report was sent to CIA headquarters declaring Pope's disappearance. The next day, Alan Dulles sent a telegraph message to CIA operatives in the Philippines, Taiwan, and Singapore. Abort mission. Destroy the evidence and retreat. No one in Washington could have imagined that the operation would end the way it did.
It certainly appears that the 34th man to occupy the White House will be 43-year-old John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
With Kennedy in the White House, a policy of mending relations with Indonesia was pursued. The major part of this new approach was for the military to support and train Indonesian army personnel, especially since the army had its doubts about Sukarno and the Communist Party. Military aid was a method that the U.S. had tried and tested in many other parts of the world. This option was used as leverage for the U.S. to reach its goals in the chosen country. The plan was for one-third of the general staff of the Indonesian Army and half of the officers' unit to be trained by the U.S. till 1963. Among those officers was a general by the name of Suharto. He had a history of cooperating with Dutch and Japanese forces in the 1940s. In late 1965, after some offices of American oil companies in Indonesia were seized, the U.S. ambassador to Indonesia, Howard Jones, tried to persuade the army to take control. In the March of the same year, he wrote, "An attempt to bring about an unsuccessful coup by the Indonesian Communist Party can be the most influential step in creating a change in the current political affairs." By mid-1965, Sukarno had survived 7 assassination attempts, but the perpetrators were unknown. On July the 26th, 1965, Marshall Green was appointed the new U.S. ambassador to Indonesia. CIA operatives in the embassy prepared a confidential meeting between Adam Malik and the ambassador. Malik was a former minister in Sukarno's administration, but he had distanced himself due to some disputes. Then he had been recruited by the CIA. After Marshall Green's meeting with Adam Malik, Green learned that Suharto and Malik intended to lead a new movement in Indonesia to get rid of communism. Ambassador Green states that he ordered all 14 emergency intercoms in the embassy to be handed to Suharto. This way, he gained safe and untapped communication access with Suharto, and the CIA could also monitor the developments. A small group of army officers abducted 6 generals and killed them. They occupied a few strategic points in Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia. They then declared on the radio that these actions were taking place to prevent a coup that was planned for October the 5th, the National Army Day. They stated that the coup was designed by the CIA and was intended to overthrow President Sukarno. But in the evening of that day, the army, led by General Suharto, crushed the rebel officers. Suharto claimed to have crushed the coup attempt by the Communist Party and supported by the Chinese. Yet, there was very little evidence to prove his claims. At last, the army found the opportunity it was waiting for to completely eradicate the Communist Party. In the year that followed, Suharto's soldiers killed thousands of the government's enemies. They were mostly members of the workers' and farmers' unions. Everything took place in a complete media blackout. Yet gradually, as fragments of news and information were leaked and uncovered, the pieces of this bloody puzzle came together. One location in Jakarta was overlooked, and its influence and role in the events was not known for many years to come: the U.S. Embassy. During the past 55 years, very little information about the U.S.'s role or its prior awareness of the coup in Indonesia has been published. The U.S.'s role was always denied by U.S. officials at that time. with Suharto's killing machine in full swing, the U.S. Embassy provided Suharto with a list it had prepared prior to the coup.
After the September 30 affair occurred, an Indonesian came to me who was closely connected with the military, the Indonesian Army. So we talked, and I passed anywhere from 1,000 to several thousand names in these various lists. I do not know the exact number. Over a period of perhaps a couple of months in November, December 1965.
In October 2017, a series of documents were unclassified, including 30,000 pages of the U.S. Embassy's documents in Indonesia. The documents clearly prove that the U.S. had complete knowledge regarding the crackdown and killing of thousands of people that took place during the coup by Suharto. Telegram A-298, secret, U.S. Embassy, Jakarta. The army had already executed many communists, but this fact must be very closely held. The extent of army repression of the PKI was being carefully held from Sukarno. From U.S. Embassy Jakarta to state, secret. At least 100,000 people have been killed in the army-organized campaign against alleged PKI supporters, including at least 10,000 in Bali. The killings would continue for several more months, resulting in an estimated 80,000 dead. Airgram A-353, secret. Suharto's support of or order for mass killing of PKI supporters, which has reached a stage of mass executions in several Indonesian provinces. Both in provinces and in Jakarta, repression of the PKI continued, with the main problem being that of what to feed and where to house the prisoners. Many provinces appear to be successfully meeting this problem by executing their PKI prisoners or by killing them before they are captured. Upon their request, the U.S. immediately armed the militia supporting Suharto in Java, fighting against the Communist Party. In later years, Ambassador Green proudly stated that we did what had to be done, and if we had not done what we did, today Asia would be a different place. A Christian priest who was fleeing the conflict zone was witness to many of the bodies floating in the river after being killed. He estimated that more than 15,000 people had been killed in this region. 25 years later, Robert Martins, a former member of the U.S. Embassy in Jakarta, stated that what they did was a great help to the Indonesian army. They have probably killed many people, and I probably have the blood of many on my hands. But this is not all that bad. Sometimes we are forced to attack in one fateful moment. The mass killings put a horrific end to the Communist Party in Indonesia. in April of 1966, while President Sukarno tried to put a stop to the massacre, General Suharto accused him of being involved in the first coup and forced him to step down from power. Eventually, in May 1967, Sukarno, who had no other political ally, was put under house arrest. In the years that followed, the U.S. provided Suharto with support to keep him in power. He was in power till 1997 in Indonesia, one of the greatest and most populated Muslim nations in the world. Years later, in a confidential meeting of the International Relations of the Senate, Ambassador Green estimated that 500,000 people may have been killed in Indonesia, but of course, no one really knows. When asked if the U.S. was involved, Marshall Green gave a strange answer. He said, "No, we did not create the chaos. We only rode on the waves coming to shore."
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Lawyers for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange are suing the US Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, and its former director Mike Pompeo in a lawsuit filed in a New York district court on Monday, 15th of August. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at Agence France-Presse. The piece is titled Julian Assange lawyers sue CIA over alleged spying. Lawyers for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange are suing the US Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, and its former director Mike Pompeo in a lawsuit filed in a New York district court on Monday, 15th of August, alleging the agency recorded their conversations and copied data from their mobile phones and computers. The attorneys, along with two journalists joining the lawsuit, are Americans and allege that the CIA violated the U.S. constitutional protections for confidential discussions with Julian Assange, who is Australian. The suit alleges that the CIA worked with a security firm contracted by the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where Assange was living at the time, to spy on the WikiLeaks founder, his lawyers, journalists, and others that he met. Julian Assange is facing extradition from Britain to the United States, where he is charged with violating the U.S. Espionage Act by publishing U.S. military and diplomatic files in 2010 related to the Afghanistan and Iraq wars. Robert Boyle, a New York attorney representing the plaintiffs in the lawsuit, said the alleged spying on Assange's attorneys means The WikiLeaks founder's right to a fair trial has now been tainted, if not destroyed. There should be sanctions, even up to dismissal of those charges, or withdrawal of an extradition request, Boyle told reporters. The lawsuit was filed by attorneys Margaret Ratner-Kunstler and Deborah Herbeck, and journalists Charles Glass and John Goetz. They all visited Julian Assange while he was living inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London under political asylum, since withdrawn. The lawsuit names the CIA, former CIA director and former US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and a security firm Undercover Global as defendants. The suit alleges Undercover Global, which had a security contract with the Ecuadorian embassy, swept information on their electronic devices, including communications with Julian Assange, and provided it to the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. In addition, it placed microphones around the embassy and sent recordings as well as footage from security cameras to the CIA, the lawsuit alleges. This, the attorneys claim, violated privacy protections for US citizens. Julian Assange is awaiting a ruling on his appeal of the British extradition order to the United States. The charges he faces could bring a sentence of up to 175 years in prison. The lawsuit alleges that while Undercover Global controlled security at the embassy, each visitor had to leave their electronic devices with a security guard before seeing Julian Assange. The information contained on the plaintiff's devices was copied and ultimately given to the CIA, it reads. Defendant Mike Pompeo was aware of and approved the copying of information contained on plaintiff's mobile electronic devices and the surreptitious audio monitoring of their meetings with Julian Assange, the lawsuit claims. Meanwhile, Julian Assange's family have said the Australian government needs to intervene in the case before Julian is extradited to the United States, saying it would effectively be a death sentence for the WikiLeaks founder if there was no intervention. The plight of Julian Assange, who is being held in Britain's Belmarsh prison pending an appeal against his extradition to the United States, has been raised with the new US ambassador to Australia, Caroline Kennedy, by Julian Assange's Australian solicitor, Stephen Kenny. Assange's father, John Shipton, and his brother, Gabriel Shipton, had raised concern that there had been little progress made since the May election and urged the Australian Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, to make the issue non-negotiable with the US. The family expressed frustration that they had been unable to secure a meeting with either Prime Minister Anthony Albanese or Foreign Minister Penny Wong. Since the election, Anthony Albanese has said the government intends to pursue the matter diplomatically, saying, "Not all foreign affairs is best done with a loud hailer." Gabriel Shipton, Julian Assange's brother, said he had initially been encouraged by Albanese's remarks as opposition leader that enough is enough with regards to Assange's incarceration, but was frustrated with a lack of progress since last May's election.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The people of Morocco recently protested against the visit of the Israeli regime's military chief of staff to the country. They have decried the deepening of ties between Rabat and Tel Aviv following the normalization of relations under the Abraham Accords. Moroccans have been resolute in their opposition to the normalization deal. Hello and welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. In the first part of our program today, we are focusing on the opposition by Moroccans to a normalization deal between the kingdom and the Israeli regime. The people of Morocco have also continued to voice their support for the liberation of Palestinian territories occupied by Israel. The second segment of our program will be on recent deadly protests in the Democratic Republic of Congo against United Nations peacekeeping troops in the country.
Moroccans oppose normalization with Israel. Moroccans have protested a visit to the country by the Israeli regime's military chief of staff, Aviv Kochavi. The controversial visit was the first time a high-ranking Israeli regime's military official publicly visited the repressive kingdom. While the monarchy in Morocco is bulldozing the normalization deal, the masses in this country are vehemently opposed to the Israeli regime.
Moroccans seize every opportunity to express solidarity with the people of Palestine who are engaged in a struggle to free their land occupied by the Israeli apartheid regime. A prominent politician opposed to normalization says people in Morocco fully support the Palestinian cause.
Our presence here at this demonstration, to which many Moroccan citizens from different creeds are taking part, is a message to the Palestinian people in Jerusalem and elsewhere, so that they know that their cause is also ours.
Now, to discuss more on the opposition to Morocco-Israeli normalization, we contacted Zakir Ahmed, an attorney, activist and political analyst. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time today.
Oh, it's a pleasure, and thank you for having me.
Moroccans, including human rights activists and civil society members, protested the visit of the Israeli regime's military chief of staff. The masses are denouncing Morocco-Israeli ties following the shameful normalization of relations brokered by the United States. Now, why is the monarchy in Morocco ignoring the voices of the majority?
The visit by the occupation entities head of military would be indicative of a policy that Morocco has already established as far back as 1963 under the Mossad head, Mir Ami. What had happened there is that relations already began between Morocco and Israel, and that was within the security sphere. What we are seeing now by Aviv Kochavi and this visit is something that has built on by a previous visit by Yair Lapid, who was the foreign minister at the time. And it is this coalescing of the two apartheid regimes. We know that Morocco is firmly involved in denying the rights of the people of Western Sahara, the Sahrawi people. And similarly, Israel is an occupying force. So therefore, we have this commonality in the flagrant violations of human rights and international law.
It is becoming more evident that the normalization of relations between Morocco and the Zionist entity, which officially took place in 2020 during President Trump's tenure, was not merely a political step, but rather a military alliance between Israel and the North African Arab country.
The visit by the top Israeli commander is a clear indicator of an emerging illegitimate military alliance. A Moroccan activist reacts here to the visit by the head of the Israeli military, which is infamous for its atrocities, including killing infants.
We consider this general a war criminal because we can never forget the killings he committed against the Palestinian people, whether women, children or elderly, as well as what he did in Jerusalem and southern Lebanon and Syria. So he is a criminal who is unfortunately being welcomed today.
Now, why is the Israeli regime keen on strengthening military ties with Morocco by selling deadly weapons to this North African country?
Is very clear. Israel is the 10th largest exporter of weapons in the world. The index indicates that it accounts for 2.5% 2.4, 2.5% of the global contribution to weapon sales. And it also does not come as a surprise that Morocco is one of the largest importers of military weaponry from the global market. Now, when you look at Israel and we hone into Israel and Morocco, you see that Israel has provided a large number of weapon systems to the Moroccan government, and this has come with a beautiful price tag. Recently, you had three Heron drones that were sold to the Moroccan regime for $50 million USD. This is a lucrative relationship for Israel. Israel wants to sell its weapons and often markets it as being field tested against the Palestinian people. You cannot get something more disgusting than that. They use the Palestinian people, their lives, their children, their mothers, fathers, husbands, and wives as guinea pigs for their weapon systems. So it is about money. It becomes about an economic question, and it's simply for the benefit of these individuals and not reflecting the will of the people on the ground.
Moroccans say the visit by senior Israeli regime officials is an insult to the history of Morocco and a betrayal of the positions of the Moroccan people who have traditionally supported the liberation of Palestine. The masses in Morocco are expected to escalate their protests and compel the monarchy to abandon this disgraceful normalization deal.
Actually, it's quite disgusting that the Moroccan regime has established ties initially covertly with the Zionist entity and now continues to do so in a public and open fashion, as if there is no shame that is to be held in the hearts of these officials that they are coalescing and moving around and connecting with and acting in tandem with the Zionist entity, which practices apartheid, which practices colonialism, and is a scourge to the world. The answer to the people of Morocco is to protest, to organize, and continue their principles of mobilization. Yes, the struggle in the Western Sahara is one part, but the other aspect is that you have to support these types of protests to change foreign policy. These are the answers. It's organization, it's protest and consistency.
Journalists in Morocco have also categorically rejected media normalization with Israel, describing it as a crime against Palestinians, Moroccans and humanity. Now, the statement came after the Israeli regime's I-24 news channel announced the opening of two offices in the country. Now, what exactly is the Israeli regime media pursuing in Morocco by establishing offices there?
I think the indication comes very clearly from an interview that was held with Major General Yossi Kupervaser, who was the former head of Israeli Defense Force Research and Development. And he's repeated this, and this has been repeated by other officials as well, that the issue is narrative war. The biggest problem for Israel, apart from military campaigns by the resistance and the defeats that they suffer at the hands of the resistance, is the global pressure that develops and continues to pursue Israel after the military operations. We have seen in the recent days there was an operation in Gaza, and this was a preemptive strike by Israel that resulted in massive inconvenience and damage to the Zionist entity. We had places like Sderot being completely evacuated, the people being moved to Haifa. You had Beersheba coming under attack, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Tel Aviv. Yes, that's the one part. Now, the bigger problem is that Israel and its only principle is that of deterrence capacity. It is the establishing principle of Israel that they have to act in a manner that is tandem with hooliganism.
The monarchy in Morocco and the Israeli regime are concerned with Algeria's growing importance and influence in Africa and the West Asia region. Morocco has its long, well-known disputes with Algeria over the Western Sahara issue, while the Israeli regime is very annoyed by the extensive Algerian efforts over the past 2 years in Africa to prevent it from joining the African Union as an observer. The Algerian president has also categorically rejected the normalization of ties with Israel.
And now our last question. Now, how have ties with the Israeli regime affected Morocco's relations with its neighbor Algeria?
There has been accusations against Algeria that they have fully supported the Polisario Front within Western Sahara. There have been issues there as well. And there have been sanctions that were placed between the countries. There was limiting of trade, etc., with the exclusion of gas. So the relationship recently and the collapse thereof has been attributed to Israel and Morocco establishing these open ties. What was also problematic was the meeting that I referred to in August of last year, 2021, by the then Foreign Minister Yair Lapid, now the Prime Minister, and he made certain very damning allegations that were unsubstantiated, that Algeria is playing a role of destabilization within the region. His greatest fear was the closening relationship between Algeria and Iran, and Iran is the greatest exporter of terrorism, etc. The general Israeli narrative is nothing new. However, these types of comments and statements by Israeli leaders in Morocco would naturally sour relations between Algeria and Morocco. Yes, there's a backdrop of bigger issues and other issues. However, this does contribute to the increasing split between the two nations.
Well, our guest there says that the Israeli regime is pursuing an evil agenda of increasing tensions between Morocco and Algeria. Thank you very much, Zakir Ahmed, for your insight. We now take a short break before our next segment, which is on the uprising against United Nations troops in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Stay with us.
An uprising against UN troops in Democratic Republic of Congo.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Tensions have continued to rise in the restive east of the Democratic Republic of Congo after weeks of deadly protests against UN peacekeepers. 36 people, including four UN peacekeepers, died recently as hundreds of angry protesters attacked UN buildings in several cities in eastern frontier provinces.
This is not the first time protests have broken out against UN peacekeepers in eastern Congo. However, these recent events have brought to the surface the persistent challenge facing the United Nations Organization Stabilization Mission in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, MONUSCO. The United Nations mission in the Congo has long suffered a crisis of confidence among local communities. It has been accused of failing to protect civilians and improve security in the region, despite a presence spanning more than two decades.
A Congolese citizen explains here reasons for their resentment towards the UN peacekeepers in this mineral-rich Central African country.
We've been watching the UN mission since the start. They have the logistical capacity they need. What are they doing with that? This is why we need to kick them out.
Now to discuss the tensions between the people of DR Congo and UN peacekeepers in the country, we contacted Kambale Musavuli, a Kinshasa-based human rights activist and analyst with the Center for Research on the Congo. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, first, tell us, what is the source of the protracted insurgency and violence in the mineral-rich eastern DRC?
It's very important to look at the conflict in the Congo from the context that the war started in 1996. This war in 1996 was a war of invasions for two of Congo's neighbors, Rwanda and Uganda. They invaded the Congo again in 1998. And since the peace accord was signed in 2002, Rwanda and Uganda have been supporting proxy militia groups in the DRC. So when we look at the M23 uprising now, if we do not understand it from the context, we will be confused with Congo having many rebels. Who are these rebels? Who is backing them? But the M23 rebels who have caused the latest havoc in DRC are a proxy militia group of Rwanda who are displacing population, who are killing Congolese people, who are looting resources as well. And it's been documented for the past decade.
The Democratic Republic of Congo has been rocked by protests against the United Nations Organization Stabilization Mission. Protesters accuse the decades-long UN mission of failing to protect civilians frustrated by an endless cycle of violence.
I came to protest against MONUSCO. It has been years since the mission came to Congo. Many Congolese have been killed in the east.
Are the Congolese people justified in their protests against UN peacekeeping forces?
No, absolutely. I mean, I understand the sentiment of the Congolese population. The Congolese population has watched for almost two decades now the UN forces in the country. The UN came in the Congo in a mission that they call MONUC, which was transformed to MONUSCO. It's a mission to stabilize and bring peace in the DRC. We have not had stability, and we have not had peace. And it's a $2 billion budget project in the DRC the UN mission. So when you see how much money is being spent for it, and you see that the intended goal is not happening, that every week we have reports of killing, especially in the east, in different areas, it is normal to actually see the Congolese actually upset about the situation.
The UN first deployed an observer mission to Eastern Congo in 1999. After a decade in 2010, became MONUSCO, the United Nations Organization Stabilization Mission in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. MONUSCO was mandated to conduct offensive operations against insurgents and armed groups. Many Congolese now believe that MONUSCO has forgotten its mandate and are now demanding that the UN troops must leave.
We want to see how to remove MONUSCO from our area because they seem to have forgotten that their mandate in Congo is to protect us.
MONUSCO has a current strength of about 16,300 uniformed personnel, making it the world's largest UN mission. However, despite its strength, this United Nations peacekeeping force with an annual budget of around $1 billion has failed to restore peace and protect civilians in the region.
The problem in the Congo, the conflict in the Congo, is a political problem. It cannot be solved by military means. And Patrick Kammert, which, a former UN commander in the DRC, said it very clearly, that you can put military pressure to bring an end to the conflict, but as long as there is no aggressive diplomacy, there is no pressure on negative forces that are known, those who are fighting with the guns on the ground will feel that they can continue to commit crimes. So this is what we think will help in DRC to bring about the end, to make sure that the UN forces are effective. We need aggressive diplomacy in putting pressure on negative forces against the Congo, in this case, Rwanda and Uganda. And then we'll see actually the mission be successful at what they were sent there to do. If that does not happen, we'll continue to see UN forces observing the killing of the population. That's been one of the frustrations of the Congolese people.
Celestine Bala, head of the Congolese Armed Forces, told the regional commanders that the process of setting up a sub-regional force to combat the negative forces should be initiated immediately. He added that all foreign fighters in the country must also leave.
Que tous les groupes armés étrangers actifs en République démocratique du Congo.
All foreign armed groups active in the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, are to be disarmed and returned immediately and unconditionally to their respective countries of origin. Otherwise, they will also be considered as negative forces and be subject to military action by the sub-region, East Africa Community.
Now, can the Kinshasa government restore peace in the region with the assistance of regional forces?
As far as we know, Uganda will still be part of that mission. The Congolese government has shared the strong reservation of having Rwandan forces in that group. So we don't think, I personally do not think, at the Center for Research of the Congo, we do not believe that a regional force will bring about peace and stability. What we believe will bring about peace and stability is the implementation of the recommendation of the UN Mapping Exercise Report. And what are these recommendations? One, particularly that the Congolese people support, is the creation of an international tribunal for Congo. The reason why it's important, as Dr. Mukwege stated, the Congolese Nobel Peace Prize winner, Dr. Mukwege said that the crimes of yesterday are going to continue until we send a strong message to the criminals on the ground that if you kill the Congolese, you will be tried and there will be justice for the victims. So since 1996, we have not had this process. And why does it have to be an international tribunal? It's because some of the perpetrators of these crimes are not Congolese. So they cannot easily be brought to justice in the DRC if there is not an international framework or training them. So to end the conflict, to end the killing in DRC, we need justice. The justice will come through a tribunal, an international tribunal, and making sure that takes place will change the dynamics in the DRC and in the Great Lakes region.
It is quite clear that if regional countries do not take the initiative to restore peace in the Democratic Republic of Congo, then extra-regional imperialist powers will get a pretext to continue their intervention and further plunder this mineral-rich country.
And now my final question. What role can regional blocs play in bringing peace to the troubled eastern DR Congo?
I think that regional blocs, particularly SADC, the East African Community, should also play aggressive diplomacy on destabilizing forces of the Congo so that they do not continue to interfere in Congolese politics. At the level of the African Union, it's the same. We're finding ourselves with the African Union being silent on the situation in the Congo and still loud on the situation in Ukraine. One will ask, why isn't the African Union engaging constructively for peace and stability? The framework that they created for peace and stability in the Congo is to have Angolan president play the role of a mediator between Congo and Rwanda. But the situation is not necessarily around mediation. No, it's a continuous destabilization of DRC. So the African Union also has to engage.
Well, there you have it. The conflict in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo can only be solved through diplomatic initiatives by African countries and the African Union in particular. I'd like to thank our guest, Kambale Musavuli, for his incisive analysis today. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
U.S. immigration policies have forced desperate people to traverse inhospitable landscapes along the U.S.-Mexico border. We're prepared for you an article written by Peter Jung. The piece is titled, The Other Death Valley. Hundreds of migrants are dying in remote Texas deserts. Eddie Canales can't forget the moment he saw the decomposed body of a young man in his 20s hanging from an oak tree on a South Texas ranch last September. The intense heat and humidity in this arid scrubland had quickly rotted his flesh to expose much of his skeleton, which had been at the scene for at least a week. Clearly visible in a graphic image the sheriff's office provided to the Guardian was the skull, lolling to one side, and both his feet are missing, probably eaten by wild animals. According to ID documents found, the man was from Mexico. Police explored the possibility it was a lynching, but concluded it was suicide. Eddie Canales, who runs the South Texas Human Rights Center, a non-profit organization based in Brooks County, Texas, working to put an end to the avoidable, harsh deaths and reunite families with the remains of their loved ones, said, "Most of the bodies I encounter are already skeletonized," he added, "but this was particularly harrowing. That image will stay with me forever." Brooks County covers almost 1,000 square miles of sparse, brush-covered sandy ranchlands not far from the eastern end of the U.S.-Mexico border and is at the heart of a deadly migration crisis that is seeing desperate people die in record numbers. So high is the grim death toll that the surrounding region, spanning several Texas counties near the Rio Grande, has been called the Other Death Valley. Data bears out that terrible nickname. The Missing Migrants Project, an initiative by the Swiss-based International Organization for Migration, IOM, that tracks migrant deaths and disappearances globally, recorded 715 deaths of people trying to cross the U.S. border from Mexico in 2021. More than double the figure in 2015, making it the deadliest land crossing in the world. According to a report by the University of Texas's Strauss Center, of the four U.S. states along the border with Mexico, Texas has the longest stretch and the highest number of migrant deaths. Brooks County, where authorities recovered 119 bodies last year, has had more deaths than any other Texas county over the last three decades. Don White, county deputy sheriff, said, "We're struggling to deal with all the bodies." Last year, the county was provided with a mobile morgue by the state in response to the grisly human reaping. He said, "I recently had to pick up three fresh ones in a day." Outside experts believe that the U.S. federal immigration policies have exacerbated the tragedy, forcing migrants into ever more perilous crossings and leading refugee journeys, fleeing violence, persecution and climate disaster to an anguished dead end. Eva Moyer, an associate professor at the University of Texas studying the precarity faced by migrants, says the Migrant Protection Protocols, or MPP, also known as Remain in Mexico, a policy introduced in 2019 under the Trump administration, have resulted in more than 70,000 people being sent back into Mexico to wait for their U.S. court cases, often for extended periods in makeshift camps, where they are often denied basic health care and they face violence, rape, murder, and kidnappings by organized crime groups. Eva Moya says the risk continues to increase. Asylum seekers in Mexico are fearing for their lives, and smugglers are taking